why this disaster could happen. Carol finally sat down, sliding lower and lower until only his head peeked above the theater's gray velvet seatback. His knees were actually pressed against the wooden stage in front. The computer system on Wall Street is a complete disgrace. Carol's eyes finally rose and took in the meeting's speaker.
Jesus.
He was taken aback by the sight of Caitlin Dillon on the podium. Her hair was bobbed at the shoulders, a sleek chestnut brown. Long legs, slender waist. Tall, maybe 5'10". She was staring down at the first row. Her brown eyes were very calm, measuring everything they saw. Yes, she was staring directly down at Carol.
Are you expecting trouble during my briefing, Mr. Carol?
Her eyes had fastened onto his magnum, his beat-up leather shoulder holster. He was embarrassed by her question and the way his name had sounded through her microphone. Those pale red lips seemed to be mocking him. Carol didn't know what to say. He shrugged and tried to sink a little deeper into his seat. Why didn't he have one of his usual wisecracks to throw back at her? Caitlin Dillon smoothly switched her attention back to the audience of senior police officers and Wall Street businessmen. She resumed her briefing at exactly the point where she had interrupted herself. In the past decade, she said, and her next chart efficiently appeared on the screen at her back. Foreign investment in the United States has skyrocketed. Billions of francs, yen, pesos, Deutschmarks have flowed into our economy to the sum of $85 billion. He watched attentively. Nothing could have drawn his eyes away from her, short of a second Wall Street bombing raid. There was a twinkle in her eyes, an unexpected hint of sweetness in her smile. Was it really sweetness, though? How could she hold down the job she had if she was sweet? Sweet was not in the Wall Street lexicon. She was chic, even in a conservative salt-and-pepper tweed business suit. Most of all, though, she looked untouchable. That was the single word that seemed to sum up Caitlin Dillon best. Untouchable. His attention drifted back to her speech, which was a succinct description of the Green Band emergency, of the current state of Wall Street's insufficient computer records, and the stoppage of all international transfers of funds. She had some sobering and scary material up there on the podium. Surprisingly, there has still been no further contact by the terrorist group, whatever kind of group they are. As you may know, no actual demands were made, no ultimatums. Absolutely no reason has been given so far for what happened on Friday. There'll be another meeting after this, for my people and for the analysts. We have to get something going with the computers before the market opens on Monday. If not, I would expect major unpleasantness. The meeting room was suddenly still, the scraping of feet, all paper shuffling stopped.
Are we talking about a stock market panic? Some kind of crash? What sort of major unpleasantness? Someone called out.
Caitlin paused before she spoke again. It was obvious to Carol that she was choosing her next words with extreme care and diplomacy.
I think we all have to recognize that there is a possibility, even a likelihood, of some form of market panic on Monday morning.
What constitutes a panic in your mind? Give us off, for instance, a senior Wall Street man spoke.
The market could lose several hundred points very quickly, in a matter of hours. That's if they decide to open on Monday. In Tokyo, London, Geneva, the subject's still under discussion.
Are we talking about a potential Black Friday situation? Are you saying there could actually be a stock market crash?
A voice rose from the back of the auditorium. Caitlin frowned. She recognized the speaker, a stiff, stuffy bean counter from one of the larger Midtown New York banks.
I'm not saying anything yet. As I suggested before, if we had a more modern system of computers down here, if Wall Street had joined the rest of the 20th century, we'd know a lot more. Tomorrow is Monday. We'll all see what happens then. We should be prepared. That's what I'm suggesting. Preparedness. For a change.
With that, Caitlin Dillon abruptly stepped down off the auditorium stage. As Carol watched her walk alone to the back doors of the room, he became conscious of another figure approaching him from the side. He turned in his seat and saw Captain Francis Niccolo from the New York City Bomb Squad, a cop who liked to think he was something of a dandy in his three-piece pinstriped suit and sleek, waxed mustache.
"A moment, Arch," Niccolo said, and gestured for Carol to follow. They hurried out of the room and along various dimly lit stock exchange corridors, Carol trailing behind. Niccolo opened the door to a small inner office tucked directly behind the trading floor. He closed it with a secretive gesture when Carol was inside.
"What's happening?" Carol asked, both curious and slightly amused.
"Talk to me, Francis."
"Check this," Niccolo said. He pointed to a plain cardboard box propped on the desk.
"Open it. Go ahead."
"What is it?" Carol hesitantly stepped toward the desk. He laid the tips of his fingers lightly against the box lid.
"Open it. Won't bite your widget off."
Carol removed the lid.
"Where the hell did this come from?" he asked.
"Christ, Frank." "Janitor found it behind a cistern in one of the men's rooms," Niccolo answered. Carol stared at the device, at the length of shiny green ribbon that was wound elaborately around it.
"Green band."
"It's harmless," Niccolo said. "It was never meant to go off, Arch." Arch Carol continued to stare at the makings of a professional terrorist's bomb.
"It was never meant to go off," he thought. "Another warning?"
"They could have totaled this place," Carol said with a sick feeling. Niccolo made a clucking sound with his tongue and the roof of his mouth.
"Easily," he said. "Plastique, like all the others. Whoever did it knew what the hell he was up to, Arch."
Carol wandered over to the office window and peered down into the street, where he saw New York cops standing all over the place, where he saw the incomprehensible war zone. Chapter 23. Using a single tine of his fork, Sergeant Harry Simkowski surgically punctured each of the three sunny-side-up eggs staring up from his breakfast platter. He lathered on a thick wave of ketchup, then buttered and spread strawberry preserves on a row of four hot-toasted bialy halves. He was ready to rock and roll. The superb, greasy spoon meal was as usual, corned beef hash, eggs, and bialy breakfast. The place was the Dream Donut and Coffee on 23rd Street and 10th Avenue. The meal arrived at the table approximately 3 hours into his day shift driving for vets. Simkowski had been looking forward to the food all through his first dreary hours on the road. Harry Simkowski almost always went through the same exact thought process while he was devouring breakfast at the Dream. It was so unbelievably good to be out of that piss and shitting hole Erie VA hospital. It was just so goddamn tremendous to be alive again. He had a valid reason to keep going now, to get really psyched about his life. And it was all thanks to Colonel David Hudson, who happened to be the best soldier, the best friend, one of the best men Simkowski had ever met. Colonel Hudson had given all the vets another chance. He'd given them the Green Band mission to get even. Later that same morning, as he slalomed through the deep slush of Jane Street in the West Village, Colonel David Hudson thought he might be seeing apparitions. He finally leaned his head out of the half-rolled vet's taxi window. His green eyes sparkled intensely against the street's murky gray. He shouted ahead into the cold, driving rain, the dripping winds ripping and grabbing at his face.
"You're going to rust out there, Sergeant. Get your pitiful ass inside."
Harry Simkowski was solidly perched outside in his familiar, battered aluminum wheelchair. He was huddled zombie-like against the drowning rain, right in front of the vet's garage entrance. It was an incredibly moving sight, probably more sad than weird, Hudson thought. A true retrospective on what was ultimately accomplished in Vietnam. There was Harry Simkowski, as poignant as any journalist's picture taken of the wounded in the Southeast Asia combat zone. Hudson could feel a tightening of his jaw muscles, and the beginnings of an old rage. He fought against it. This wasn't the time to allow himself the luxury of personal feelings. This wasn't the time to wallow in old, pointless anger. Stemkowski was grinning broadly by the time David Hudson finally jogged to the weathered door of the vet's garage.
"You're Section 8 for life, Sergeant. You're out of your mind," Hudson said firmly. "No explanations accepted."
Actually, though, Hudson was beginning to smile. He knew why Stemkowski was waiting outside, knew all of the vet's sad sack stories by heart now. He was betting everything on knowing the vets at least as well as he knew their military histories.
I wanted to be right here, when you got in. That's all it was, Colonel.
Hudson's voice softened.
"Yeah, I know. It's real good to see you again, Sergeant. You're still an asshole, though."
With an audible sigh, Colonel Hudson suddenly bent low. He then easily scooped up the 137-pound bundle of Harry Stemkowski with his powerful good arm. Since the spring offensive of 1971, Stemkowski had been a helpless cripple. Harry Stemkowski had also been a violent, totally incurable stutterer ever since he'd been splattered with 17 rounds from a Soviet SKS automatic rifle. A pitiful wreck, right up until a few months ago, anyway. As he pushed his way to the top of the cramped, mildewed stairway inside Vets, Hudson decided not to think about Vietnam anymore. This was supposed to be an R&R party. Green Band was a rousing operational success so far. George Thorogood's "Bad to the Bone" blared loudly from the room above. "Good tune, good choice." "It's the Colonel himself." As he stalked inside a large, drab yellow room on the second floor, Hudson heard shrill hollers and shouts all around him. For a moment he was embarrassed by the clamor. Then he thought about the fact that he'd given these 26 veterans another lease on their lives, a purpose that transcended the bitterness they had brought back from Vietnam.
"The Colonel's here. Colonel Hudson's here."
"Well, shit. Hide the good Johnny Walker booze."
"Just kidding, sir."
"How the hell are you, Bonanno? Hale? Scully?"
"Sir, we goddamn did it, didn't we?"
"Yes, we did. So far, anyway."
"Sir, it's great to see you. Went just like you said it would."
"Yeah, the easy part went great."
Chapter 24. The 26 vets continued to cheer. Hudson shielded his eyes as he stared around at the dingy room where they'd been plotting together for almost a year and a half. He scanned the rows of familiar faces, the scraggly, home-cut beards, the unfashionably long hairstyles, the drab green khaki jackets of the vets. He was home. He was home, and he was obviously welcome. He could feel the vibrations of unadulterated warmth that these men felt toward him. And for one brief moment, Colonel David Hudson almost lost control. Hudson finally offered a wry, conspiratorial smile.
"It's good to see you all again. Carry on with your party. That's an order."
Hudson ambled on, gripping hands, greeting the rest of the vets group. Jimmy Cassio, Harold Friedman, Mahoney, Caresti, McMahon, Martinez. Men who hadn't been able to fit back into American society after the war. Men he'd recruited for Green Band. As he walked, Hudson thought about his men, his final combat command, the final mission. The vets were antisocial, chronically unemployable. They were dramatic losers by the standard American measurements of success and accomplishments. At least half of them still suffered some form of PTSD. The post-traumatic stress syndrome so common among war veterans. The men packed into the cab driver's locker room had performed spectacularly. Every one of them had served under Hudson at one time or another. Each was a highly trained technical specialist. Each had a totally unique skill, which no one other than Hudson seemed to want or need in civilian society. Steve, the horse Glickman, and Paulie, Mr. Blue, Melendez, were the finest rifleman sniper team Hudson had ever commanded. Michael Dowd and Joe Barrero were experts at ordnance, at assembling and creating complex plastique explosives. Manning Rubin could have been making $1,000 a week for either Ford or GM, if his skill at fixing automobiles had been matched by patience, just a little ability to handle bullshit. Davy Hill had an encyclopedic knowledge of just about everything, including the stock market. Campbell, Bowen, Kammerer, and Generali were high-caliber professional soldiers and mercenaries. "All right, gentlemen, we have to do some homework now," Hudson finally spoke. "This is the last time we'll have the chance to review these details and any of our operating schedules. If this sounds like a formal military briefing, that's because it damn well is." Hudson paused and looked around at the circle of assembled faces. Each was turned toward him with intense concentration. "Personal anecdote, gentlemen. At the highly thought of JFK school at Fort Bragg, they repeatedly told us that genius is in the details. When the truth of that finally sunk in, it held like nothing I've ever learned before or since. So I want to go over the final details one last time, maybe two last times with all of you. Details, gentlemen." Vets 1 had purposely modeled his presentation after the concise and technical Special Forces field briefings. He wanted the men to vividly remember Vietnam now. He wanted them to remember how they'd acted, with daring and courage, with dedication to the United States. Hudson could feel his body pulsing and tingling lightly. He spoke to the men without using written notes. For nearly 2.5 hours, Hudson painstakingly reviewed every scenario, every likely and even unlikely change that might occur up to and including the end of the Green Band mission. He used memory aids, reconnaissance topographical maps, mnemonics for memorizing, Army-style organization charts. A graveled voice finally sounded from the shadowy rear of the vet's locker room. One of the combat mercenaries, a southern black named Clint Hurdle, had taken the floor.
"Why are you so sure there won't be no attacks of conscience?" "This going to heat up now, Colonel. Who says nobody going to fuck up and run?"
There was a hush around the room. Hudson considered the question carefully before answering. He had posed almost the same question hundreds of times in his own head. "Nobody, not a single one of you men, broke during combat. Not even in a war none of you wanted or believed in. Nobody broke in POW camps. None of you will break now, either. I'm prepared to bet everything on that." There was an uncomfortable silence after the question and emotional answer. David Hudson's intense eyes slowly surveyed the vet's dressing room one more time. He wanted them to feel that he was sure about everything he just said, even though it might not look it. Every man in the room had been hand-picked from hundreds of possible vets. Every soldier in the room was special. "If any one of you wants to leave, this is the time. Right now, gentlemen. This afternoon. Anybody?" One vet slowly started to clap. Then the rest of them. Finally, all 26 men were solemnly clapping their hands. Whatever was going to happen, they were together. Chapter 25. Colonel Hudson nodded. The military commander once again took control. "I saved the foreign travel assignments until last. I'm not going to entertain any discussion, any disagreement over these assignments. The operational environment is already confused. We will not be confused. That's another reason we're going to win this war." Colonel Hudson walked to a long wooden table. He began to pass out thick, official-looking portfolios. Each one had a white tag pasted onto the front. Inside the envelopes were counterfeit U.S. passports and visas, first-class airplane tickets, generous expense monies, copies of elaborate topographical maps from the briefing. The genius was in the detail. "Cassio will go to Zurich," Hudson announced. "Demkowski and Cohen have Israel and Iran. Scully will go to Paris. Harold Friedman to London, then on to Toronto, Jimmy Holm to Tokyo, Vic Fahey to Belfast. The rest of us stay put right in New York. A schoolboy's groan went up. Hudson silenced it with a short, chopping hand motion. Gentlemen, I'll say this one time only, so you have to remember it. While you're in Europe, in Asia, in South America, it is absolutely essential that you act, that you groom and dress yourselves in the particular style we've laid out for you. All your air travel arrangements are first class. All your clothing and restaurant expense money is meant to be spent. Spend that money. Throw it around. Be more extravagant than you've ever been in your lives. Have fun, if you can, under the circumstances. That's an order. Hudson eased up. For the next few days, you have to be self-assured, successful American business types. You have to be like the people we've been studying on Wall Street for the past year. Think like a Wall Street man, look like one, act like a high-powered Wall Street executive. At 04:30, you'll be given corporate haircuts, shaves, and, believe it or not, manicures. Your wardrobes have been carefully selected for you, too. They are Brooks Brothers and Paul Stewart, your favorite shops, gentlemen. Your shirts and ties are Turnbull and Asser. Your billfolds are from Dunhill. They contain credit cards and plenty of cash in the appropriate denominations you'll need in your respective countries. Colonel Hudson paused. His eyes slowly roamed across the room. I think that's all I have to say, except one important thing. I wish you all the very best luck possible. I wish you the best in the future after this mission. I believe in you. Believe in yourself. Chapter 26. It was 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon when Carroll kicked both weathered Timberland work boots up on his desk inside number 13. He yawned until his jaw cracked. He'd finished 4 draining and futile interrogations. He'd been lied to by the very best, the most dangerous provocateurs and terrorists from all around New York. Carroll had purposely chosen a cramped office for himself, tucked away at the back of the Wall Street building. His small but hardy DIA group, a half-dozen unorthodox police renegades, 2 efficient and extremely resilient secretaries, surrounded the uninspiring office in a satellite of Wall Street-style cubicles. Paint peeled from the walls of Carroll's office like diseased skin. The windowpane had been shattered courtesy of Green Band. He tacked a square of brown paper to the hole, but rain-soaked through anyway. The first 4 suspects Carroll had interviewed were known terrorists who lived in the New York City area. 2 FALN, a PLO, an IRA fundraiser. Unfortunately, the 4 were no more knowledgeable about the Wall Street mystery than Carroll was himself. There was nothing circulating on the street. Each of them convincingly swore to that after exhaustively long sessions. Carroll wondered how it could be possible. Somebody had to know something about Green Band. You couldn't calmly blow away half of Wall Street and keep it a state secret for over 40 hours. The scarred and rusted wooden door into his office opened again. Carroll watched the door over the smoking cardboard lid of his coffee container. Mike Caruso, who worked for Carroll at the DIA, finally peeked inside. Caruso was a small, skinny, ex-office cop with a black 50s pompadour pushed up high over his forehead. He habitually wore wretched Hawaiian shirts outside his baggy pants, attempting to create a splash of colorful identity in the usually drab police world. Carroll liked him immensely for his dedicated lack of style. "We got Isabella Marquesa up next. She's already screaming for her fancy Park Avenue lawyer. I mean, the lady is fucking screaming out there." "That sounds promising. Somebody's upset, at least. Why don't you bring her in?" Chapter 27. Moments later, the Brazilian woman appeared like a sudden tropical windstorm inside the office.
"You can't do this to me. I'm a citizen of Brazil."
"Excuse me.
You must be mistaking me for somebody who gives a shit. Why don't you sit down? Carol spoke without getting up from his cluttered work desk.
Why, who do you think you are?
I said, sit down. I asked the questions, not you. Carol leaned back in his chair and studied Isabella Marquesa. The Brazilian woman had shoulder-length, gleaming black hair. Her lips were full and painted very red. There was an arrogant tilt to her chin. Her hair, her clothes, even her skin seemed expensive and cosmopolitan. She had on tight gray velvet riding pants, a silk shirt, cowboy boots, a half-length fur jacket. Terrorist chic, Carol thought. You dressed like a very wealthy Che Guevara, Carol finally smiled.
I don't appreciate your attempt of humor, senor.
No? Well, join the crowd. Carol's smile now broadened. I don't appreciate your attempts at mass murder. Carol already knew this woman by reputation. Isabella Marquesa was an internationally renowned journalist and news magazine photographer. She was the daughter of a wealthy man who owned tire factories in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Though it apparently couldn't be proved, Isabella Marquesa had sanctioned at least 4 American deaths. She was responsible, Carol knew, for the disappearance, then the cold-blooded, heartless murders of a Shell Oil executive and his family. The American businessman, his wife, their 2 small girls had vanished that past June in Rio. Their pitiful, mutilated bodies had been found in a sewer ditch inside the favelas. Marquesa reportedly worked for the GRU through Francois Montserrat. According to rumors, Isabella had also been Montserrat's lover. She tossed Carol the coldest, most indignant look he could imagine. Her dark, sullen eyes smoldered as she stared him down. Arch Carol wearily shook his head. He set aside the steaming coffee container. The impression he got from Isabella was that of a tempest about to unleash its force. He watched as she leaned forward and thumped her hands on the desk. The fiery light, the gleam in her dark eyes was something.
I want to see my lawyer. Right now. I want my lawyer. You get my lawyer. Now, senor.
Nobody even knows you're here. Carol spoke in a purposefully soft, polite voice. Whatever she did, however she acted, he would do the exact opposite, he decided. Carol knew that 2 of his agents had intercepted Isabella Marquesa as she walked down East 70th Street after leaving her apartment that morning. She'd screamed out, struggled, and fought as they grabbed her off the streets.
Somebody, please help me!
6 East Side New Yorkers, with the anesthetized look of people observing a distant event which interests but doesn't particularly involve them, had watched the scene. One of them had finally yelled as Isabella Marquesa was dragged, fighting and sobbing, into a waiting station wagon. The rest did nothing at all.
You people kidnapped me off the streets, Isabella Marquesa complained.
Her red mouth pouted. Let me confess to you. Let me be honest and kind of frank, Carol said, still going gently. In the last few years, I've had to kidnap a few people like yourself. Call it the new justice. Call it anything you like. Kidnapping's lost most of its glitter for me. The louder Isabella Marquesa got, the softer Carol's speaking voice became. I kind of like the idea of being a kidnapper. I kidnap terrorists. It's got a nice ring to it, you know. Don't you think?
I demand to see my lawyer. God damn you. My lawyer is Daniel Curzon. You know that name?
Arch Carol nodded and shrugged. He knew Daniel Curzon. Daniel Curzon's a piece of sorry shit. I don't want to hear Curzon's name again. I'm serious about that. Carol's eyes now fell to a manila package, a plain-looking folder wrapped in brown string on his desk. Inside was his moral justification to do whatever he needed to do right now. Inside the tan envelope were 12 or so black and white and 35mm color photographs of the Jason Miller family, formerly of Rio, the murdered family of the Shell Oil executive. There were also grainy photographs of an American couple who had disappeared in Jamaica, pictures of a Unilever accountant from Colombia a man named Jordan who had disappeared last spring. Carol continued softly. My name's Arch Carol, born right here in New York City. Local boy makes good. Son of a cop who was the son of a cop. Not a lot of imagination at work in our family, I'll admit. Carol paused briefly. He lit up a leftover cigarette stub. Crusader rabbit style. My job is to locate terrorists who threaten the security of the United States. Then, if they're not too strongly politically connected, protected, I try my best to put a stop to them. Put it another way, you could say I am a terrorist for the United States. I play by the same rules you do. No rules. So stop talking about Park Avenue lawyers. Lawyers are for nice, civilized people who play by the rules. Not for us. Carol slowly untied the string bow on the manila envelope. Then he slid out the handful of photographs inside. He casually passed them to Isabella Marquesa. Jason Miller's body. Miller was an engineer for Shell Oil. He was also a financial investigator for the State Department, as you and your people in Sao Paulo know. A fairly nice man, I understand. Information gatherer for State, I'll admit. Basically harmless, though. Carol made soft clicking noises with his tongue. His eyes briefly met those of Isabella Marquesa. She was quiet suddenly. His putting green voice was throwing her off slightly. She obviously hadn't expected to encounter the deck of photographs. Miller's wife Judy here, alive in this photo, kind of a nice Midwestern smile. Two little girls. Their bodies, that is. I have two little girls myself. Two girls, two boys. Carol smiled again. He cleared his throat. He needed a beer. A beer and a stiff shot of Irish would go real good right now. He studied Isabella Marquesa a moment. In July of last year, you participated in the premeditated murders, the political assassination of all four Millers. Isabella Marquesa shot up from her seat in the interrogation room. She began to yell at Carol again. I did nothing. You prove what you say. No, I did not kill anybody. Never. I don't kill children. Bullshit. That's the end of our friendly discussion. Who the hell do you think you're kidding? With that, Carol slapped the wrinkled manila portfolio shut. He jammed it back in his lopsided desk drawer. He looked up at Isabella Marquesa again. Nobody knows you're here. Nobody's going to know what happened to you after today. That's the truth. Just like the Miller family in Brazil. You're full of shit, Carol. Yeah? Try me. Push me a little and find out for sure. My lawyer. I want to see my lawyer. Never heard of him. I told you his name. Curzon. Did you? I don't remember. Isabella Marquesa stared at Carol in silence. She folded her arms, then sat down again. She crossed her long legs and lit a cigarette. Why are you doing this to me? You're crazy. This was a little better, Carol thought. Tell me about Jack Jordan down in Colombia. American business accountant. Machine gunned to death in his driveway. His wife got to watch. I never heard of him. Carol clucked his tongue and slowly shook his head back and forth. He seemed genuinely disappointed. Sitting behind the bare, bleak office desk, he looked like someone whose best friend had just inexplicably lied to him. Isabella, Isabella. He gave an exaggerated sigh. I don't think you get the total picture. I don't think you really understand. He stood up, stretched his arms, fought back a yawn. You see, you no longer exist. You died suddenly this morning. Taxi accident on East 70th Street. Nobody bothered to tell you. Carol was feeling dangerously overloaded now. He didn't want to finish this interrogation. An hour passed. 2 hours. He desperately needed a drink. You were Francois Montserrat's mistress here in New York. Come on. We already know about that.
2 summers ago, right here in Waverly, York. Isabella Marquez sat with her head hanging. She wouldn't look up at Carol for long stretches of time. Her right leg kept nervously tapping the floor, but she didn't seem aware of it. She looked physically ill. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3. Black Friday by James Patterson, continuing on page 121. Who the hell is Montserrat? Carol kept up his attack. How does Montserrat get his information? How does he get information that no one outside the U.S. government could possibly get? Who is he? Carol could hear his own loud voice as if it were a foreign sound in an echo chamber. Listen. Listen to me very carefully. If you talk to me right now, if you tell me about Francois Montserrat, just his part in the bombings on Wall Street, if you do that much, I can let you leave here. I promise you. No one will know you were here. Just tell me about the Wall Street bombing. Nothing more than that. Nothing else. What does Francois Montserrat know about the firebombing? It took 30 minutes more of cajoling, threatening, screaming at Marquesa. 30 grueling minutes in which Carol's voice turned hoarse and his face red. 30 minutes during which his shirt stuck to his sweaty body before Isabella Marquesa finally stood and shouted at him. Montserrat had nothing to do with it. He doesn't understand it either. Nobody understands what the bombings are all about. He's looking for Green Band, too. Montserrat is looking for them, too. How do you know that, Isabella? How do you know what Montserrat is doing? You must have seen him. The woman clapped the palm of one hand across her hollow, darkened eyes. I haven't seen him. I don't see him. Not ever. Then how do you know? There are messages. There are whispers in private places. Nobody sees Montserrat. Where is he, Isabella? Is he here in New York? Where the hell is he? The woman stubbornly shook her head. I don't know that either. What does Montserrat look like these days? How should I know? He changes. Montserrat is always changing. Sometimes dark hair, a mustache. Sometimes gray hair, dark glasses. Sometimes a beard. She paused. Montserrat doesn't have a face. Now, conscious of having said too much, Isabella Marquesa had begun to sob. Carol sat back and finally let his head rest against the grimy office wall. She didn't know anything more. He was almost certain he'd gone as far into her as he could possibly go. Nobody knew anything about Green Band. Only that wasn't possible. Somebody had to know what the hell Green Band wanted. Who, though? Chapter 28. Faded, yellowing newspapers, at least a dozen different ones dated October 25, 1929, were haphazardly spread across a heavy oak library-style work table. The 30 and 40 point headlines seemed as jarring now as they must have been 50-odd years before. Worst stock crash ever. 12,894,650 share day. Swamps market. Leaders confer. Fine conditions found. Wall Street panic. Record selling of stocks. Heavy fall in prices. Stock prices slump $14 billion in nationwide stampede to unload. Bankers to support market today. Prices of stocks crash in heavy liquidation. Total drop of billions. 2,600,000 shares sold in the final hour in record decline. Many individual accounts wiped out completely. Wheat smashed. Chicago pit in turmoil. Hoover promises business of the country is still sound and prosperous. Caitlin Dillon finally stood up from the work table and its musty newspaper clipping. She stretched her arms high over her head and sighed. She was on the 5th floor of number 13 wall with Anton Birnbaum,
from the New York Stock Exchange Steering Committee. Birnbaum was one of America's financial geniuses. If anyone understood that precarious castle of cards called Wall Street, it was Birnbaum. He had started, Caitlin knew, as an office boy at the age of 11. Then he'd worked his way up through the market hierarchy to control his own investment house. Even at 83, his mind remained as sharp as a blade. A mischievous light still burned in his eyes. Caitlin had met Anton Birnbaum years before while she was still at Wharton. Her thesis advisor had invited the financier for a guest lecture during her final year. After one of his iconoclastic talks, Birnbaum had consented to private sessions with a few of the business school's students. One of them turned out to be Caitlin, about whom Birnbaum told her advisor, "She is extremely intense. Her only flaw is that she is beautiful. I mean that quite seriously. It will be a problem for her on Wall Street. It will be a serious handicap." When Caitlin graduated from Wharton, Anton Birnbaum hired her as an assistant at his firm. Within a year, Caitlin was one of his assistants. Unlike many of the people he hired, Caitlin would disagree with the great financier when she felt he was off base. During that period, Caitlin also began to make the Wall Street and Washington connections she needed for the future. Her first job with Birnbaum provided an education she couldn't have paid to receive. Caitlin found the financier impossible to work for, but somehow she worked for him, which proved to Birnbaum that she was as outstanding as he had initially thought she was. "Anton, who would benefit from a stock market crash right now? Let's make ourselves a list, a physical list, as some kind of starting place." "All right, let's explore that avenue. People who would benefit from a market crash?" Birnbaum took a legal pad and pencil in hand. "A multinational that has a huge discrepancy to hide?" "That's one, or the Soviets. They'd benefit in terms of world prestige anyway." "Then perhaps one of the third world madmen? I believe Gaddafi is capable of something like this. Perhaps capable of getting the necessary financing as well." Caitlin looked at her watch, a functional 10-year-old Bulova, a gift from her father one Christmas back home in Ohio. "I don't know what to try next. What are they waiting for? What happens when the market opens on Monday?" Anton Birnbaum took off his horn-rimmed eyeglasses. He rubbed the bridge of his nose, which was reddened and deeply indented. "Will the market even open, Caitlin? The French want it to. They're insisting they will open in Paris. Perhaps it's one of their typical bluffs." "Which means the Arabs want their French banks open. Some toady in Paris either wants to take advantage of this situation, or they hope to get some of their money out before there is a complete panic." Birnbaum replaced his glasses. He gazed at Caitlin for a moment. Then he gave one of his characteristic shrugs, a huffy gesture of the shoulders that was barely perceptible. "President Kearney is talking with the French. They've never appreciated him tremendously, though. We haven't been able to placate them since Kissinger." "What about London? What about Geneva? How about right here in New York, Anton?" "They're all watching France. France is threatening to open their market, business as usual, on Monday. The French, my dear, are being carefully, carefully orchestrated." "But by whom? And for what possible reason? What is coming next?" Both Caitlin and the old man were quiet for several moments. Over the years, they had become comfortable with long periods of silent thought when they were examining a problem together. "I'll tell you something, my dear. In all my years on the street, I have never felt this apprehensive. Not even in October of 1929. Chapter 29. Bergdorf's on 57th had been open all day Sunday for the usual neurotic rush of Christmas shopping. Francois Montserrat entered the department store at a little past 6:30 that evening. Another snowstorm was threatening outside. Montserrat was wearing thick, wire-rimmed glasses and an unnumberable gray tweed overcoat.
He also wore a matching hat and black glove, which created a monochromatic impression. The wire-rimmed glasses magnified his eyes for observers, but didn't distort his view of the world. He had them made by a lens grinder on the Rue des Postes in Bazette, a city north of Tunis. Montserrat quietly marveled as he got off a crowded elevator onto one of the upper floors. There was nowhere else, no city he knew of, in which one consistently saw quite so many provocative and stunning women. Even the store's perfume demonstrators were dreamily sensual and exotic. A stylishly anorexic black girl approached and asked if he'd like to experience the new opium. "I've already experienced it. In Thailand, my dear," Montserrat answered with a smile and an effete wave of the hand. A thick gallery of shoppers hugging glittering shopping bags from other department stores moved slowly before Montserrat's wandering eyes. Winter Wonderland played from a hidden stereo system. It was taxing and exceedingly difficult to move forward in certain directions, more like visiting a New York disco than a store at Christmas time. As he strolled through the store, Montserrat reflected on his reputation with a measure of pride. What did it matter if he'd been responsible for this act or that one, when his only real goal, his sole driving force, was the total disruption and eventual fall of the West? A dead Egyptian president, a wounded pope, a few Irish farms. These amounted to nothing more than grains of sand on a beach. What Montserrat was interested in changing was the direction of the tide itself. The crowd inside Bergdorf's ebbed and flowed. He finally saw the woman he followed. She was sifting through a long rack of cocktail dresses, always thinking of her appearance, always defining her existence through her reflection. Montserrat concealed himself behind a display case of sweaters and continued to watch. He felt a certain coldness in the center of his head, as if his brain had become a solid fist of ice. It was a feeling he knew in certain situations. Where other men would experience the uncontrollable rush of adrenaline, Montserrat experienced what he thought of as the chill. Every man who passed checked out Isabella Marquesa carefully. So did several of the chic, well-dressed women shoppers. Her fur jacket was left casually open. As she turned, swiveled left or right, a tantalizing glimpse of her breast floated deliciously into the breach. Of all the women in the department store, Isabella was the most desirable, the most visually dramatic by Montserrat's personal standards. Now he observed Isabella slink off toward a changing room. He put his hands in the pockets of his overcoat, caught a reflection of himself in a mirror as he moved, then he paused outside the changing room door. He walked past the closed door, studied the throngs around him pursuing Christmas gifts with forced gaiety, and then he darted back the way he had come. Pretending to examine a silk shirt, like a wealthy East Side husband picking out a stocking stuffer, he listened outside the changing room. Coming closer, he could hear the whisper of clothing as it peeled away from Isabella's skin. In one swift move, he stepped inside the tiny room and Isabella swung around in astonishment. Why did she always look so beautiful? Warmth flowed within him. He took his hands from his coat. She was wearing only panties, tight and sheer and black. The cocktail dress she intended to try on hung limply in one hand.
"Francois, what are you doing here?"
"I had to see you," he whispered.
"I heard you had a little trouble."
Isabella frowned.
"They let me go. What were they going to hold me for anyhow?
They had nothing but a stupid bluff, Francois." She smiled, but the expression couldn't conceal a look of worry. He pressed one gloved hand lightly against her breast. He could smell Balvenie, her favorite perfume. His as well.
"Are you being followed, Isabella?"
"I don't think so.
No, of course not."
"Good, good," he whispered. Isabella's mouth fell open and she suddenly stepped back against the wall. There was really no place to go in the tiny dressing room.
"Francois, don't you believe me? I told them nothing, absolutely nothing."
"Then why did they let you go, my love?"
I need an explanation. Francois, don't you know me any better than that? Don't you?
I know you only too well, Montserrat thought and stepped forward. The tiny handgun made an inconsequential guttural spit. Isabella Marquesa moaned. Then she seemed to faint, collapsing toward the black and white checkered tile. Montserrat was already out of the changing room and walking inconspicuously toward the nearest exit.
She talked. She had admitted knowing him, and that was enough.
She'd been broken during the interrogation, skillfully, in a way she might not even have recognized. Montserrat had heard the news not 10 minutes after Carol finished with her. He burst into the cold wind raking West 57th Street. He turned a corner, to all intents and purposes, a drab ordinary man, losing himself in the crowds that hunted the spirit of Christmas with red-faced eagerness. Chapter 30
I want you to have lunch with me, Mr. Carroll, Caitlin Dillon had said over the telephone.
Is 12:15 today okay?
It's important.
It was a call that took Carroll by surprise. He'd been going through his back files, sifting through terrorist organizations in his search for some clue to Green Band, when the call came.
I want you to meet somebody, Caitlin had told him.
Who?
A man called Freddie Hotchkiss. He's kind of important on Wall Street.
She had a nice telephone voice. Music in a tuneless world, Carol thought.
He put his feet up on the desk and tilted his head back against the wall. With his eyes shut, he tried to bring Caitlin Dillon's face into his mind.
Untouchable, he remembered.
Freddie Hotchkiss is connected with a man called Michel Chevron, Caitlin said.
The name rings a bell, Carol said, and tried to place it.
The information I have is that Chevron's a wheel in the stolen securities market, and, this is what should really interest you, Mr. Carroll, there are rumors of a link with Francois Montserrat.
Carol loosened his crimson and blue school tie before he took the first inviting sip of John Smith's pale ale in the dining room of Christ's Cellar on East 46th Street. He found ties uncomfortable, which was one reason he rarely wore them. Actually, he thought neckties pretty much without purpose, unless you impulsively wanted to hang yourself or get inside some overpriced New York steakhouse. Christ's Cellar required a jacket and tie. Otherwise, it was comfortable enough. Actually, it felt good to be sitting here with Caitlin Dillon. Christ's Cellar's steaks were 16 ounces at a minimum. Choice prime, and aged properly. The lobsters started at 2 pounds. The waiters were immaculate and subservient, city cool to a fault. For the moment, Carol was enjoying himself. For this moment only, Green Band had receded from his mind.
One of the first things I learned in New York is that you have to make the steakhouse a ritual if you're going to survive on Wall Street.
Caitlin smiled across the white linen of the tablecloth.
She'd already told Carol that she was originally from Lima, Ohio, and he could almost believe it, listening to her perspective on New York City living.
Even to survive in the SEC, you have to know the conventions, especially if you're a young gal, as a particular brokerage house CEO once called me. I'd like you to meet the new young gal from SEC.
Caitlin said the phrase with such casual, twinkling malice it almost sounded nice.
Carol started to laugh. Then they both laughed. Heads turned at other tables. Staid faces looked around.
Was somebody daring to have fun here?
Who?
Carol and Caitlin were waiting for the arrival of Duncan Freddie Hotchkiss, who was fashionably late, despite the fact that Caitlin had asked him to be on time. A shrimp cocktail eventually found its way to Carol's place. The fish was perfect and overpriced by at least 300%. Carol asked Caitlin about Wall Street, what it was like from her vantage point at the SEC. Caitlin began regaling him with a few of her favorite horror stories about the street. She happened to have a treasury of true, mind-bending stories which circulated in the inner sanctum but were usually not shared with outsiders.
Embezzlement has never been easier on Wall Street, Caitlin said. Her brown eyes sparkled with humor. One economist we prosecuted worked at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. At 27, he went off and bought a summer house in the Hamptons, then a new Mercedes convertible, and a Porsche, then a sable coat for his dear mom. Along the way, he managed to get in debt close to $750,000. He's still working for the government? Carol finished the second shrimp. In your story, I mean. He quits Treasury right about this time for a much better paying job. Only he takes with him the security access codes which allow him to find out enough to buy or sell on the credit and stock market. A very, very profitable bit of knowledge. He's got the ultimate on insiders' trading information. You know how it fell through? His mother called the SEC. She was worried that he was spending all this money without any job she could see. His mother turned him in because he gave her a sable fur. There was an outfit called OPM Financial Services that stood for other people's money. I swear to God, Michael Weiss and Anthony Caputo opened their company over a Manhattan candy store in the 70s. Along their merry way, Michael and Anthony managed to defraud manufacturers Hanover Leasing, Crocker National Bank, and Lehman Brothers for about $180 million. Don't ever feel bad if you lose a little money on the market. I'm real lucky in that respect. I don't have any money to lose. Why is it allowed to happen? What about the SEC? Carol was beginning to feel slightly incensed, though he'd never personally lost a dime on Wall Street. It's fairly simple, really. As I said in the beginning, these kinds of stories are rarely told outside of Wall Street. I'm honored. You should be. The Wall Street banks, the brokerage houses, investment bankers, even the computer companies, they know that the success of their marketplace depends on confidence and trust. If they prosecuted all the embezzlers, if they ever admitted how easy it was, how many stock certificates are actually stolen each year, they'd all be out of business. The point is, Wall Street is more afraid of bad publicity than of the actual theft. Suddenly, Caitlin was silent. Caitlin, will you forgive me? I'm so very sorry. Freddie Hotchkiss had finally arrived. It was 1 o'clock. He was 45 minutes late for their lunch. Carol looked up and saw a sparsely blonde-haired man with a ridiculously innocent grin on his face. He had the palest, watery blue eyes, bleached of almost all color, and a face as round and expressionless as a pie tin. What did they do down on Wall Street? Carol wondered. Were there genetic laboratories dedicated to the preservation of the pure-blooded, uncontaminated wasp strain? All of them turning out plump little Freddie Hotchkisses? Caitlin had told Carol that Hotchkiss was becoming legendary. He was a hot partner at his firm, a frequent emissary to both the West Coast and Europe, where he had extensive dealings with European bankers. Truly sorry about the time. Hotchkiss looked anything but sorry. I completely lost track, roughing it out of the pied-à-terre on Park since the trouble on Friday. Kim and the kids are staying down in Boca Raton, her mom and dad's place. Ah, what exquisite timing you have, sir. A waiter had spotted Hotchkiss arriving and had scurried to the table for the all-important drink order. Carol stared at Hotchkiss. This was a type he wasn't comfortable with and didn't particularly like. Poor bastard had to rough it on Park Avenue. I'd like a cure. Anyone for second? Hotchkiss asked. I'll have another John Smith. Carol was trying to be good. No hard liquor, no neat shots of Irish. He was also trying not to say something impulsive, something that might lose him the advantage of surprise with Freddie Hotchkiss. No, thank you. Nothing for me, Caitlin said. Freddie, this is Arch Carroll. Mr. Carroll is the head of the United States Anti-Terrorist Division, out of the DIA. Hotchkiss beamed enthusiastically. Oh, yes, I've read about you specialized police folks. The sooner someone can bring a little order to this whole unfortunate affair, the better. I heard yesterday, or maybe I read it somewhere,
that there is a Libyan hit team right here in New York, actually residing in Manhattan. I doubt it's the Libyans we're looking for, Carol remarked. He leaned forward, softly nudging a finger into Freddy's pale blue shirt, seeing a faint expression of surprise float across the man's puffy face. It amazed Carol that such a face was capable of expression. I'd like to cut out the chit-chat, okay? You're an hour late and we're pressed. I have absolutely no personal interest in you, Freddy. You understand that? I don't think I like you, but that doesn't matter. I'm only interested in a man named Michel Chevron. He's not one for small talk, Freddy. Caitlin smiled and nursed her drink. Freddy Hotchkiss, meanwhile, seemed to have stopped breathing. He looked down at Carol's finger sticking in the center of his chest. I'm not sure. I don't think I understand. I mean, I've heard of Michel Chevron, of course. Of course you have, Carol said. Tall, austere-looking French gentleman, Caitlin intervened. Hush, Louis Quatorze's offices on Rue de Faubourg in Paris. Very affluent digs in the heart of Beverly Hills. Caitlin sipped open a leather-bound notebook on the dining table. Let me see if I can jog your memory. Oh, yes. On February 19th of last year, you visited Michel Chevron's Beverly Hills office. You stayed for approximately 2 hours. On March 3rd, you visited the L.A. offices again. Also on July 9th, July 11th, July 12th. In October, you visited Chevron's Paris office. You had dinner with Chevron that night at La Serre. Remember? Can you place him yet? Freddy Hotchkiss had begun slowly clasping and unclasping his plump, hairless hands. We've known for over 2 years that Chevron is the largest stolen securities and bond dealer in Europe and the Middle East. We also know he has a personal relationship with Francois Montserrat, Caitlin continued. We know a great deal about your own security trading abilities as well. Right now, we need to know exactly who else Chevron deals with, and we need a rough idea of the nature of these deals, a general feel for the Euro-Asian black market. That's why I thought we all should have lunch, she smiled. Right then, Freddy Hotchkiss found the strength inside himself to frown derisively. He began to snap back, to rally. Really? You don't expect me to talk about private and absolutely legal business dealings here in this restaurant? You had better have all your subpoenas and your Justice Department lawyers ready, if you believe that will happen. I can assure you, it won't be done over lunch. Good afternoon, Caitlin. Carol. Carol suddenly sat up very straight at the dining table. He leaned all the way forward and did the oddest, most unexpected thing. Carol placed his forefinger behind his thumb and then flicked it 3 times very hard against Freddy Hotchkiss's starched white shirt collar. Thwack, thwack, thwack. Just sit tight now. Just put your nice soft ass back down on the chair. Try to relax, okay? Hotchkiss was so astonished, he obeyed. In a soft voice, which to Carol's ears sounded mildly seductive, Caitlin said, February 21st, you deposited $126,000 in Geneva, Switzerland. February 26th, you deposited another $114,000. April 17th, you deposited... Is this a typo? $462,000? April 24th, another $31,000. Small potatoes, that one. What Caitlin has been politely trying to point out to you, Freddy, is that you are a second-rate thief. Carol leaned back and smiled at Hotchkiss, who now sat as expressionless as a ventriloquist dummy. Carol raised his voice above the restaurant's usual buzz. Poor Kim, the kiddos wintering down in Boca Raton. They have no idea, I'll bet. Tennis pals at the club, the boys at the yacht club. They don't know either. You ought to be in jail. You shouldn't be allowed to eat here. You're such a sad piece of shit. Other diners in the expensive Midtown restaurant were beginning to place their knives and forks on their plates.
In a state that resembled a communal hypnotic trance, they stared across the upstairs room. Carol finally lowered his voice. He pointed toward a corner table where two men in dull gray suits were seated. Those two guys? See them? They can't even afford to eat the nibbles here. See, they're sharing a $3 ginger ale. That's the FBI for you. Anyway, they're either going to arrest you right here and now, or, Fred, you're going to tell us a long, very convincing story about Michelle Chevron. It's absolutely your move. And yes, it's going to happen right here in the restaurant. Then, in that second case I mentioned, you get to go home absolutely scot-free to the Pied-à-Terre Terre on Park Avenue. No problems, cause then you're my main man, see? Arch Carroll dramatically crossed his two fingers. We're tight, like that. Except, of course, you're the finger on the bottom. Freddie Hotchkiss slumped forward at the restaurant table. He hesitated. Then he slowly began to tell yet another Wall Street horror story. This one was about Monsieur Michel Chevron. It was a fascinating story of the most exclusive rat pack of thieves in the world. All of them respected bankers, high-priced lawyers, successful stockbrokers. Every single one of them was in a position of absolute trust. Was this Green Band? Carol couldn't help wondering. Was Green Band a powerful cartel of the richest investment bankers and businessmen in the world? What would be their motivation? Carol finally signaled to the two FBI guys waiting at the corner table. You can't arrest this guy now. Oh, and Freddy? I told a white lie about letting you go free. Have your lawyer call my lawyer in the morning. Ciao. Mike Caruso was outside the restaurant when Carol finally appeared. Carol's lieutenant was wearing a garish beach shirt beneath his overcoat, a devotee of summer who never embraced the winter season. He gestured Carol to step aside from Caitlin. Both policemen huddled together at the far edge of the sidewalk. I just got a report on our friend Isabella Marquesa, Caruso said. Somebody murdered her. She was shot 4 times. Carol glanced at Caitlin, who was standing several feet away, waiting for him. A lovely vision in a dull gray, wintry city. He tried to imagine Isabella Marquesa dead. Shot at point-blank range, Caruso said in the offhand manner of someone immunized against murders. It freaked out all the Christmas shoppers. Yeah, I'm sure it would. Carol was silent a second. Somebody thought she talked too much. Somebody was keeping close tabs on her. Caruso nodded. Somebody who knew her movements, Arch. Or yours. A ragged wind blew down East 46th Street, dragging around discarded newspapers. Carol plunged his hands inside the pockets of his coat and stared at the cold, grim city surrounding him. He liked this investigation less and less. He finally pointed back at the doorway of Christ's cellar. Nice place to eat, Mickey. Next time you want to blow a couple hundred on lunch. Caruso nodded. He tucked in a flap of his flowered shirt. Already had a sabretz. Chapter 31. The following morning, Anton Birnbaum, appearing on a special edition of the PBS show, Wall Street Week, explained why the destruction of Manhattan's financial district did not exactly signal the end of the civilized world. The major American market was indeed knocked out this past Friday. More markets exist out there, however, believe it or not, and they may just possibly become the beneficiaries of this disaster. These markets are the Midwestern, the Pacific, and the Philadelphia exchanges. They handle local issues as well as certain board listings. If Joe Investor has to sell 50 shares of AT&T, to meet the balloon payment on his mortgage, his local broker may well be able to make a deal for him outside of New York. Of course, he may not find a buyer at a price even close to what he's asking. Obviously, Birnbaum went on, Chicago is where the significant action is this week.
Between the Midwest Exchange and the two premier commodity exchanges, there are still plenty of opportunities for everyone to lose a lot of money. Even as he gave this purposely calming and reassuring speech, Anton Birnbaum knew that the existing situation was more tragic than he dared admit. Like almost everyone intimately connected with the market, Birnbaum expected a crash. In a way, somewhere deep in the inner recesses of his mind, he almost welcomed the purification rite, so very long overdue. As of Tuesday morning, the venerable financier had no idea how large a part he would play in Greenband itself. Chapter 32. Paris. A man named Michel Chevron. Greenband. The idea of the city filled Carroll with something akin to dread. Even as he sat inside a dark blue State Department limousine, sailing like a proud ship across Boulevard Haussmann, Carroll didn't want to look out at the streets. He didn't want to acknowledge that he was back in the French capital. The street sounds he heard pressing against the limousine were like the rattling of old bones. For Carroll, Paris was a city of sharply painful memories. Paris was Nora and himself in another age and time. Paris was a fading decal on which was imprinted the spectral shapes of two young, carefree honeymooners who wandered all the boulevards holding hands, who stopped to kiss every so often, who couldn't keep from constantly touching each other. Carroll stared at the two American flags that flapped on either fender of the luxury car. "Make believe you're someplace else," he told himself. Christ, though, the memories kept coming back like a tide.
Nora sipping café au lait on the crowded Boulevard Saint-Germain.
Nora smiling and laughing as they made all the tourist stops, the Eiffel Tower, Montparnasse,
the banks of the Seine, Le Quartier Etudier.
Carroll felt something grab tight around his heart. It was a sense of the injustice that had ended Nora's life, and it uncomfortably crowded him now. Near the Opéra Garnier, a crouching man with a reptilian face, made as if to hurl a spoiled grapefruit at the smooth, cruising symbol of American wealth and power. Seated in the gray velvet rear seat of the car, Carroll flinched at the sight of the man. But when the prospect of the grapefruit assault had passed, he relaxed a little and tried to shake his head free of the fog of overseas jet lag and confused time zones. He opened his bulky green band file and looked over scribbled notes because he knew work would be a salvation from the memories of this town. If he dug into his material,